Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson.
Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Well, this past week saw more media talking heads go on the chopping block as the legacy media collapses from irrelevance and lack of credibility. Among them, MSNBC's Joy Reid, whose propaganda program The Readout was finally canceled due to cratering ratings. Arguably the most hateful race monger in the entire media, Joy Reid now joins former media fixtures like Jim Acosta, Nora O'Donnell, Chuck Todd, Andrea Mitchell, and Chris Wallace, who bit the dust in the wake of Trump's election victory. It's a bright new day in America without these state propagandists. And with the collapse of the mainstream or legacy media, independent journalists have become our most trustworthy news sources. Investigative reporters like Michael Schellenberger, who was a guest on this show a couple of months ago, or Glenn Greenwald, whom I don't always agree with by any means. But these are independent reporters bringing astonishing revelations to light, and their primary platforms are not big networks like CNN or CBS or even Fox News, but social media accounts like Twitter. I still can't bring myself to call it X. Sorry, Elon. These men and women are out there digging up all the facts and stories that people deserve and need to hear about, the kinds of truths that Americans have been denied too often and for too long by an agenda-driven corporate media that more often than not serves the interests of the state. My upcoming guest at The Right Take is arguably the most courageous of these indie journalists, having put his life on the line to investigate dangerous radicals like Antifa, Black Lives Matter, and other domestic terror groups. We at the Freedom Center value the work he is doing so much that a few years ago we gave him our annual Annie Taylor Award for Courage in Defense of Freedom. I've been looking forward to talking to him because he's a pretty damn impressive guy with a lot of interesting revelations and stories to share. So stay with us here at the intersection of politics and culture because you don't want to miss this interview. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you don't miss any of the other important conversations we are having here. Remember, if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is an independent journalist and photographer of extraordinary courage and persistence. His reporting on the militant far left, such as Antifa, means that he lives under constant physical threat. He's testified before Congress. He's appeared all over the media. His work has appeared everywhere from the Wall Street Journal to Newsweek and back again. He's a senior editor at the Post-Millennial. Andy Ngo, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's an honor, Andy. Kudos to you for doing the gutsy reporting that you do. In my short little introduction just now, I didn't mention that in 2021, you published an absolutely riveting bestseller called Unmasked, Inside Antifa's Radical Plan to Destroy Democracy. And before I get into asking you about Antifa, I'd love for you to tell us, as you did in the afterword of the book, a little about your background and how you chose this path, what motivates you as the son of immigrants to this country to put your life on the line in defense of the American way of life by doing things like going undercover with Antifa.
Well, I started off in journalism as a student at Portland State University, and it was in November 2016 when I was assigned to cover the protests that were announced in reaction to the election win of Donald Trump, which was a surprise to everybody, and people went crazy over it, violently crazy. And I had, I think at that time, an iPhone 6 or 7 in 2016 and was just shocked at what I saw. I had never seen groups of people masked up, and at that time it was unusual to wear a mask in public, and they were dressed in black, and they were destroying my home city, smashing up vehicles, starting fires in the streets, and the way it was covered in the press the day after, and the weeks after, and the years after that, is that these were racial justice protests and protests against fascism, when what I saw was organized crime. So I spent the next 5 years really digging into this who these people are and what they organize around. I learned pretty quickly that they called themselves Antifa. They claim to be anti-fascist. They use tactics of violence and organized crime to achieve their goals. They view the free speech as the primary enemy. They believe, like, unfortunately, many liberals believe that speech empowers hate, and hate leads to fascism. Therefore, you must silence your opponents by any means necessary. And if it includes maiming them, you do that. If it includes getting them fired, you do that. And if you need to kill them, you do that as well. So it led ultimately to me getting beaten by them quite viciously in 2019. I was very lucky to survive that. I suffered brain bleed in downtown Portland from that. And I wrote a book that came out in January 2021. It documents primarily the riots that happened across the United States in 2020 in the name of George Floyd, and the conspiracy behind that from networks of far less violent extremists who were able to operate with impunity in jurisdictions where Democrats had power.
Yeah, and that attack, that very violent attack that you suffered, that pretty nearly killed you, actually, and they got virtually no repercussions for that. But you ultimately brought a lawsuit against Antifa for that attack, right? Tell us how that civil trial played out.
Yeah, so back in 2019, when the first beating happened, there unfortunately was another one in 2021. But with the first one, I was naive at that time, and I really thought that the fact that it happened in front of a courthouse in downtown, a street away from the Central Police Station, that the law enforcement would do the right thing and to investigate properly and bring about charges. And I just kept waiting, and nobody was ever prosecuted over that attack. Not a single person was charged. And so I saw civil claim, and I was supported and helped by Ms. Harmeet Dhillon, who's having her confirmation hearing today in the U.S. Capitol. And she and her nonprofit, Center for American Liberty, represented me. And after years of litigation, it went to trial in the summer of 2023. It was a very big lawsuit. It involved six individuals who I alleged had injured me through assault and battery, and also Rose City Antifa, which is the Antifa cell in Portland, Oregon, was also in the lawsuit. It was filed in Multnomah County, where Portland is, and unfortunately, a judge dismissed Rose City Antifa from the lawsuit because claiming that in Oregon state law, since it wasn't a registered entity, we couldn't bring a civil claim against them, even though they have social media account, website, a Q&A on their website to about inquiring how you can join to become a member. And so that part was dismissed. But the lawsuit with the six individuals went forward. There were two at trial. And I always knew it was a huge uphill battle. The jury was going to be pulled from Portland. And this is a city, of course, that demonizes good people and brave people, and people who stand up for truth are driven out or silenced in some way. And after a week and a half of a civil trial, one that required me to re-traumatize myself to sharing in detail these assaults from the past, the jury did find the two not liable. However, that wasn't the end of the story. There were three in the lawsuit who have a judgment of default against them, and I am continuing to pursue what I'm owed from those individuals. I haven't seen a penny yet, but I'm not giving up.
Well, good luck. When you were attacked, those must have been moments when you asked yourself whether you should continue to embrace the life of a journalist whose life would constantly be in danger, or abandon that and take a new and safer career direction altogether. What prompted you to go forward and choose the former path?
When I was hospitalized for the 2019 assault, I had a lot of time to think because I wasn't allowed to sleep. When I didn't know anything about traumatic brain injuries, but if a patient in a hospital has bleeding on the brain, there's a risk that you could fall into unconsciousness if you are allowed to sleep. So the nurses and hospital staff would come in every time they see me doze off a bit. I was so exhausted after everything I went through, and I couldn't sleep. So I had a lot of time to think. I was just awake and in pain. And I thought, okay, maybe this is the end of the road for me. Like, I mean, my goal is not to subject myself to be violent to violence or to become a martyr. You know, my goal is to tell the truth. And if people are going to try to kill me for that, I don't see how I can continue. At that time, I was working primarily independently. I was doing freelance writing for a number of publications like Wall Street Journal and other places, Newsweek, New York Post. But I didn't have any institutional support, really. So I thought, I can't go on. But then I just, in that night, that first night, as I kept thinking, I just thought, I can't let this act of violence silence me. That's their goal. I have to be smart about it. You know, I can't go out in the same way that I did before. I have to think about different ways. And I gave up something that was really precious to me and precious to a lot of people. They don't think about it. It's just being able to move freely in public. And that was something I had to give up in my city because I really became a target, number one, after I survived that. The far left and their allies, even in the mainstream left, viewed me as somebody who needed to be targeted with violence if I was seen at any type of public demonstration engaging in my civil rights. And I had to give that up. And so I focused more on writing. And that was very, very challenging in shifting, giving up such an important part of how I gather information, which is being on the field. A lot of journalists don't have a lot of field experience, but you know, for me, it was inverse. I did start off in the newsroom, and then I grew out of that to being on the field and recording so many of these videos. But I continued with that, and I think in 2020, with the riots that happened after George Floyd, I was undercover, and that was very, very risky. I didn't have the resources to hire private security. Private security, close protection detail will cost several thousand dollars for one evening. And, you know, the riots went on for months in Portland. So I took a really big risk going back out undercover, but I needed to see with my eyes what the militants were doing in downtown and in other places around the city as they mobilized night after night after night. The charges were dropped because we had a new district attorney come in who was himself very open about his far left political ideology. And so there was this crazy phenomenon where the violence was essentially sanctioned by the state because it was deemed as opposing police, opposing the first Trump administration, and fighting, and I'm quoting with my fingers here in the air, racism. And all these lies made decent liberals look the other way or offer their support through donations to various groups that provided certain aid to the rioters. And unfortunately, that's the legacy that Portland has to deal with now. 5 years on, the city is in an urban death spiral. It has now for years after year after year net migration out of the city, which for a couple of decades hasn't happened. There's just been population growth every year into Portland. But that's changed since the riots. Public safety is a big issue, homelessness issues, issues with recruiting officers to join the Portland Police Bureau. and it's losing its tax base, and outside investors do not want to invest in Portland for a number of good reasons, and I've had to flee Portland as myself as well. So I gave up being around my family and my upbringing and relocating quite far away just because of the death threats against me quite accelerated a lot in 2020.
Oh, just awful. Well, we don't hear much about Antifa in the news these days, but that doesn't mean they're any less active as a radical organization, especially in Europe, it seems, or any less of a threat to democracy here, does it?
Yeah, I just read a piece that came out in the Spectator U.S. edition in print, asking basically, where is Antifa now and what are their next steps? So they've retreated a bit from what they're most known for, which is their involvement in these riots in quite large numbers. And a number of things have happened in the last 4 years. One, there hasn't been another large mobilization movement on the streets of America like it was with George Floyd. And there was a lot of agitation in the last couple of years from the far left and Antifa for the Palestine issue, but it didn't grow in the same type of size to what the demonstrations were for BLM. And Antifa, as a violent extremist movement, those who are willing to wear the black uniforms and bring the melee weapons and guns, that number of people is actually relatively small. And so they need to embed themselves into larger protest movements to act as sort of agitators to turn the crowd into fellow rioters or fellow looters or human body shields. That's very important. And they just didn't have that opportunity anymore. So their tactics for attacking in criminality have shifted in the form of small-scale attacks that are done discreetly. For example, smashing up a target, starting a fire, setting police cars on fire, setting a bridge on fire even. That's happened in the Portland area last year. Attacking property that is linked to Tesla, for example. And then they'll claim it in these anarchist websites where there's a claim of responsibility. And also targeting pro-life pregnancy centers as well. That's another big target, and targeting even churches and houses of worship. So that's how their tactics have shifted. And it will take the effort of federal authorities to really, it'll take work for them to actually uncover the conspiracy and charge some of these individuals with conspiracy charges or RICO. But I think that's what needs to happen. And it's San Diego County actually showed that that's possible. Last year, there was a really big trial that I covered after years of investigations, a trial against two members who didn't plead guilty, who were alleged to be part of a SoCal Antifa over a violent attack on Trump supporters a few years earlier. It went to trial, and both of them were convicted by a jury of felony conspiracy and other charges, assault, etc. And 12 people were charged. Two went to trial. The others pleaded guilty. So all 12 were charged or convicted, excuse me. And so, you know, the San Diego case, the district attorneys did an incredible job of revealing that this is not an unorganized group of people who have no connection to one another. Actually, through the signal communications that were uncovered from some of their devices and other evidence that was shown at trial, they were highly organized as SoCal Antifa, and they mobilized people from LA, from San Diego, from Long Beach, and other areas in Southern California to carry out a criminal conspiracy, and they were convicted. And in Georgia State, in Fulton County, the Georgia Attorney General is prosecuting a RICO case against dozens of people accused of being part of this network of Antifa that have carried out violent attacks on the public and a first responder training facility that was under construction for several years south of Atlanta. And that case is ongoing. It involves some interesting suspects, including people who are international from Canada, from Europe. One of those who were charged in that RICO case is a SPLC attorney. So there are cases that I think federal prosecutors can look to in different jurisdictions to see what they're doing to try to dismantle some of these cells that operate in the dark.
What would you say to people who buy into this sort of mainstream narrative about Antifa that, as Joe Biden himself put it, Antifa is just an idea, not an organization? And in fact, that was reiterated on The View not too long ago when Joy Behar said, oh, Antifa is just an idea. What would you like to say to people who buy into that narrative?
Well, it's an intentional downplaying of the danger of this movement. I mean, they are an ideology, but that's not all that they are. It's like saying that neo-Nazism is just an ideology. Yeah, there are people who espouse that ideology, but it doesn't stop there. There are people who organize into neo-Nazi cells and have certain websites, they have forums, some of them meet in person, some of them have convicted for planning violence against other people, some have been convicted for crimes. So you have to think of Antifa in the exact same way. It's an ideology that radicalizes people, and people organize online. They meet in person. They are more formalized cells. There are some loose affiliations. And sometimes the radical is just an individual, like some of these jihadist ideologies where a person self-radicalizes through social media and things online and decides to take out action in some violent criminal type of way. Antifa do all of the above that I just stated. So I mean the deception of Antifa is to plant in the minds of the public and in liberal media that it's just an idea of anti-fascism and that it stops there, and that anybody who's against fascism is an Antifa person. And if you are against Antifa, that means you're sympathetic to fascism, or worse, you're a fascist yourself and should therefore be subjected to violence.
To shift gears a little bit, lately you've been almost single-handedly pursuing a story that is just mind-boggling about this trans-vegan cult that's behind a string of half a dozen murders or so over the last few years, including a border agent in Vermont. Can you sum up what that's all about?
Yeah, so in the last 5 years, what I've noticed developed from Antifa is that there has been this phenomenon in America where transgender identifying people are being radicalized into violent extremism. Trans people were overrepresented among the arrestees of the 2020 BLM Antifa riots, and they themselves have staged a number of violent direct actions to attack people who peacefully protest some of these controversial children's drag queen events, etc. And they come armed with weapons, and they have their own propaganda about killing their opponents, killing transphobes, giving firearms and knives to trans people to arm them against society. And when the shooter in Nashville, the transgender shooter, killed children and staff who worked at a school, there was this big protest by trans activists in the Tennessee Capitol just a few days after, and there was a quote-unquote moment of silence for the victims of that shooting, and they held up seven fingers. There were six people who were killed by Audrey Hale, and they included a seventh finger because they were honoring Audrey Hale herself. They viewed her as a victim and somebody they were somewhat sympathetic to, or fully sympathetic to. And so out of that, I've reported a lot on leftist trans extremism And I coined the term Trantifa to describe this phenomenon of radical leftist anarchist politics and also transgenderism, like this merging of it together. And so it led me to really want to investigate the killings that have happened across the U.S. the last few years involving alleged members of a group who follow a transgender leftist ideologue named Jack LaSota. The media has called them Zizians. They don't refer to themselves as such, but Ziz is the alias of Jack LaSota, the leader. And its members are accused of being linked to at least 6 violent deaths that are known so far. There's also been several suicides of members of the group, and that hasn't been formally linked to the organization itself. But there's just this trail of bodies, and the story went wide out into the open when the U.S. Border Patrol agent on Inauguration Day in January 2025 was shot dead near the Canadian border in Vermont. And it was from there that its links through the suspects were established in these other states, in Pennsylvania, in California. And it goes back years, and the members are almost all transgender in some way. They are geniuses. They're young adults who were brilliant teenagers and children even, who have science degrees and went to top universities. Some of them worked for NASA, some worked for Google, and they chose this allegedly to join this organization that lived at one point in a commune in the Bay Area, and it relocated to several different places. But the ideology that espouses radical anarchism, veganism, and this belief that it is completely rational to kill people who get in your way as a form of justice, seeking your own justice, and even engaging in what they call self-defense. And this is how Antifa justifies their violent actions. They don't view, for example, when Antifa maims somebody, like smashes somebody on the head with a bike lock or a frozen water bottle, they don't view that as just an act of violence. They say it's self-defense. They say that we are defending ourselves from what you believe. So similarly, the Ziz terror group, through the writings of Jack LaSota, believe it's perfectly justifiable to take out people who somehow get in your way. And this includes, some of the victims have been a landlord, an elderly man who they allegedly tried to assassinate in 2022. He was impaled. He had his eye cut out in this horrific sword attack when they were squatting on his property. And he took steps to get the sheriff's office involved to evict them. And they allegedly thought that he needed to be killed for that. He survived because he had a firearm. And then fast forward 2 years later, in January of this year, a few months before the trial is set to start in Solano County, California, he, being the only person who witnessed that attack a couple years before, he was assassinated. He had his throat slit by an alleged member of the group. And, you know, I'm just highlighting one of the profiles of the victims. There are several others.
So this isn't just an isolated story of a, let's call it, demonic crime spree like the Charles Manson murders this trans vegan cult. It's part of a larger trend of trans violence and radicalism.
Yes, I would say so, because there's actually, if you look at what trans activists are saying online, a lot of them have actually been showing sympathy for the Ziz group. They have praised some of the actions. It says base that they killed a Border Patrol officer, and that these are trans women who are fighting for their rights, and they're willing to take it to take it as far as it needs to defend trans rights. So, and also the fact that when legacy media and liberal media has been covering this, they've also been downplaying the trans aspect. In fact, if you read a lot of the headlines and the stories themselves, they'll focus on, they'll just say that they're a vegan group. And then they won't mention or they'll downplay the trans part. So they'll use the preferred pronouns. They use even the preferred aliases. So you, as a reader, if you are not familiar with this case through reading other reports, like reading my reporting, you can come out thinking that this is just, you know, a murderous group of violent young women, which is completely wrong.
Along these lines, what is your take on not only the recent assassination of this healthcare CEO by radical anti-capitalist Luigi Mangione, but maybe more significantly, the widespread support that he is receiving as a sort of a folk hero?
I'm so glad you brought that up. So that this phenomenon we see of young people in particular celebrating him, not just being sympathetic to certain aspects of what his manifesto said, but actually viewing him as doing the right thing and that others should take up similar actions against other CEOs, that's really well documented in, and you can see through the money that's pouring in from the public through the legal aid for him and all these fanboys and fangirls lusting after his act of violence and lusting after him as an individual. And I think what that demonstrates is there's been, and this is the theme of my writing for the last 7 years, is that there's a certain normalization of political violence that's happening on the mainstream left that's not been acknowledged. And so it's continuing to fester and grow. And we can see it now where not only are people feeling like, oh, you know, a case is complicated, you know, maybe there was some righteousness in XYZ. No, now they're openly saying, it was good that he killed these people. It was good that somebody tried to kill President Trump when he was campaigning. And it's too bad that that person wasn't successful. We were hearing some of these views online, extremist views. And it's coming more and more from the mainstream left. And the Democrats have been in denial about political violence and where it's really coming from. The press and all these counter-extremism research organizations that are nonprofits and get public funding, all of them only focus on right-wing extremism. They ignore one huge part of extremism that exists, and it's manifesting itself now in, you know, these violent riots, arson attacks, killings, violent conspiracies, all that. And the left doesn't just sees it as a non-problem because they're not being fully informed.
We've covered a lot of ground here in just a short period of time, but what issue or threat or group that's out there do you find the most concerning right now, or maybe that you feel most compelled to investigate?
Well, the story about the trans terror cult is not done just because the leader was arrested with several other comrades a week and a half ago. There's still several members who are at large. The trial of the two in California is really at risk because the prosecution now has this difficulty of proving beyond a reasonable doubt murder and attempted murder when the witness to that is no longer able to testify because he was murdered. So, and also, I revealed this in my reporting, one of the two that was charged under a fake name and also a fake birthday. This is the problem with these members are all about deception. That's why they use aliases. And I think the defense in that trial would try to exploit this question about the identity of one of the defendants. The fact that the prosecutors wasn't able to identify who this person is, and for 3 years the charging documents have a false ID. That's a big deal. The case of Jack Lesoto, we'll see how that plays out, but part of me is holding my breath because the arrest of Jack Lesoto happened in rural Maryland, and he's charged with nonviolent misdemeanors. he was trespassing allegedly, and he had a firearm illegally, and resisted arrest, or one of his comrades did. And so, like, he hasn't been accused formally in any jurisdiction, federally or statewide, of any of the four other murders that have happened. So prosecutors are going to, I think, will have a hard time finding this evidence of him radicalizing his members into doing the killings. I think the case is has a lot of parallels to the Charles Manson cult, that, you know, how Charles Manson himself wasn't killing people, but instead was influencing his devotees to do it. And I believe that is the is what happened here.
Yeah, very shocking. Andy, two questions. One, do you have a new book in the works or that you are contemplating? And two, where can people go online to follow you and support the invaluable work that you're doing?
I have big projects planned, and people who want to see what I'm working on now can, and read my reporting, go to andy-ngo.com.
Great. Andy Ngo, thanks again for joining us today. Keep up the great work, and please stay safe.
Thank you.
Listeners, make sure you follow Andy Ngo, because he is on the cutting edge of some of the most vital stories of our time. And don't forget to pick up a copy of his book, Unmasked: Inside Antifa's Radical Plan to Destroy Democracy. It is a riveting read. I can vouch for that. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you don't miss any of the important conversations we're having here. And remember, if you like what you hear, please leave a positive review. Thank you, and see you next time. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.